Golf Smarter number 67 for March 27th, 2007.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Billy Bondurek returns as Teacher of the Year.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Okay, so let's discuss the intro you just heard. We've just launched a new home for the Golf Smarter podcast. SmarterPodcasts.com is our attempt to take advantage of what we believe is the greatest opportunity to provide meaningful, important content to audiences of discerning taste like you. We're creating programs for communities. And what I mean by communities are content that is for people with passions or concerns. In most cases, the format will be similar to Golf Smarter, whereby we interview experts in a given field who can share stories, insights, tips, and advice. Golf is a community, so obviously our flagship program is Golf Smarter. Other programs we've launched this week are Good Dog, Smarter Cancer Care, and Radio Baseball Cards. Shows coming up in the near future, and this one is because you've been asking a lot about it. We're going to do a golf show on equipment and technology. And the first show will have interviews with the head designer at Nike and the vice president of R&D at Titleist. And we'll bring in Kenny Nicholson to explain the whole thing as well. It's called the Edwin Watts Golf Podcast, and that'll be coming up in the next few weeks. Other programs include Drummers, Work Smarter, Drive Greener, Drive Smarter, Borrow Smarter, Parent Smarter, and a whole lot more. Get the theme? Podcasting's a passion for us, but we've also got to make some money too. So we hope to follow the lead of Golf Smarter and get online retail companies to come on and educate you on how to be smarter shoppers. The goal is to have sponsors who are consistent with the content so that there's something in it for you as well. Please check us out. We're at smarterpodcasts.com. And then you can subscribe to the shows that interest you. If you have a topic that you feel needs to be covered, please write to me and we'll review your request. I've been overwhelmed at the success of Golf Smarter, and I want to thank you for your continued support and feedback. Golf Smarter is brought to you in part by the Bird Golf Academy. Check out the Bird Golf Academy by clicking on their link at golfsmarterpodcast.com. Remember, all listeners of the Golf Smarter Podcast receive an exclusive 10% discount to the Bird Golf Academy. Now's the time to get signed up because it is golf season, my friends. Now, for today's program, Kenny Nicholson of Edwin Watts Golf will answer a question about choosing the right club head, and he gives a fascinating explanation about club head design and manufacturing. Our guest today has been with us once before, and I'm really happy to have him back because he offers great advice. The author of The Seven Myths of Golf and a regular contributor to the mental game at PGA.com, Billy Bondurek. Welcome back, Billy.
Well, thanks, Fred. Great to be back.
Congratulations. You were just recently named the Northern California PGA Teacher of the Year.
Yeah, it was quite an honor. It really is.
You know, the thing that I hate about awards in my business is you have to submit your work, you know, and pay to enter, and then they recognize you.
Uh-huh.
That's not how it works for you, is it?
No. We get recognized by one another. Other PGA professionals do the nominating. So it's pretty cool to go through that and have other people recognize you. And it's a blessing, you know. I work hard at it, so it's been wonderful.
That's fabulous. So now, this is not the NCGA.
No, it's the NCPGA, Northern California Professional Golf Association, our section up here in Northern California. I think there's something like 12 or 1,300 card-holding members, and then probably double that for apprentices.
And what, the NCGA is like part of the USGA?
The NCGA is part of the USGA.
Yeah.
The Northern California PGA is, there's 41 sections in America in the PGA. One for Northern California, Southern California. There's a Southwest section which encompasses Arizona and I think part of Nevada, and you know, and the sections are grouped like that, so it's not just one per state. It's broken up into different areas.
I want to go back and get the basis of understanding of how you got to develop your life into becoming a teacher. So let's go back, and you didn't start playing golf in your 20s, I assume.
Oh, no, no. I started really at a young age. My dad was a very good golfer. He was a state amateur champ back in Massachusetts, and one of his close friends, a gentleman by the name of Ted Bishop, was a U.S. amateur champ, and I grew up as a little guy just wanting to hang out with Dad, and I'd go to the golf course and caddy for him. And I remember one of my earliest memories is I didn't really see any bad shots ever. So
How would you know?
Yeah, exactly. For a long time there, I didn't think there was such a thing, you know.
I guess that's the difference when I go out and I play with guys who, like myself, started playing, we'll call it later in life, versus guys who've been playing all their lives. It's just so effortless for people who've been playing since they were little kids.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really a unique experience watching those guys play. Some of my fondest memories from back then. Ted Bishop was a really cool guy, and he would show me things and just his mental imagery. He was like Picasso out in the golf course. He'd call me over and say, I got to keep it underneath the tree limbs here and cut it over that brook, and it's like hard pan over there, so it's going to hit that hard pan, and I think it's going to run through that bunker because it's a really shallow lip, and he'd pull it off, and it would hit the lip and bounce out of the bunker 5 feet from the pin, and it'd look at me and go, Picasso. And it was just so neat. It was like his club was the paintbrush, and the ball was the paint, and the golf course was the canvas.
Oh, that's beautiful. And as a kid, did you get it?
Oh, yeah. I fell in love with the game. You know, the imagery and just, you know, I think as a little guy, you're always more of a visual learner. But him and my dad, they taught me a lot about the golf swing that, you know, is emerging now. I mean, they knew a lot about the golf swing back then. Back then, I remember learning the differences between what an upright swing does and a flat swing does, and there's two different sets of principles on the downswing for both of those. And that's the mechanical side. But once you know that, what those principles are, it becomes really clearer to you when you make a mistake. And you can kind of, well, you're in a position to fix it a lot faster. Whereas I see a lot of people out there struggling with their golf swings, and they just don't understand the principle of what they have to do.
And neither do I. Let's just take it from there.
Okay.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, the mechanical side of it?
Well, the flat versus...
Okay, upright.
Yeah.
Well, with an upright swing, and nowadays it's called the two-plane swing, but it's really upright. Your arms swing upright and your shoulders turn, so there's two different planes. And in a upright swing, your arms have to drop, and they have to cast the club. And a lot of people think you're supposed to hold on to your angles due to perhaps what Ben Hogan once said in his book. But now if you think about it, Ben Hogan was a flat swing. So an upright swing, the left arm pulls down, the right arm extends, and the club has to be cast with the wrists. Now that's three things, and now your body has to kind of counterbalance that because you got maybe 25 pounds of arms dropping and swinging and casting. That amount of weight would pull you off balance. So the body has to make a lateral bump blended with turn. We're up to five things. And the upright swing, the hands should rotate more through impact. If you're a flat swing, and I think this is where Ben Hogan, in a way, could have... I'm not going to say he messed up people, but what he talks about, or what he did talk about in his book, was the right elbow digging into his side. And the way I learned it is the right elbow just stays next to your side. And your forearm and hand kind of slap or throw towards the ground. Now your right forearm comes down, but your elbow doesn't move in front of your stomach. And at the same time, you're just turning. So the flat swing does two things, and the upright swing has to do six. And it's kind of funny, when you watch tour pros today on TV, this is interesting, this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there's a four-way playoff down in Florida, and all four of those guys playing in the playoff were more or less one-plane flat swings. I think it's an easier swing to maintain, but here's the big mistake. A lot of people who swing the club back flat do some two-plane downswings. In other words, they pull their arms. But if you think about it, if your arm is more upright, when it pulls down. When your arm comes across your chest and swings around, when you pull it, it doesn't go down. It comes way out in front of you. That would be a common mistake. You follow?
No.
Not really?
I'm a visual learner.
Okay.
And that's why on this program, and I'm sounding stupid here, but on this program, I try to talk about the mental side.
Okay.
And I want to continue with this. Just because I don't understand doesn't mean you can't explain it, because you're a quality teacher. And so you lost me.
All right. You know, to have an imagination in the golf swing, there's certainly it's sometimes is misunderstood by people with, you know, beliefs that are already ingrained. And kind of, in other words, it's the problem to create something new these days. You have to, at the same time, be consistent with everything that we've seen before, and that can sometimes be extremely difficult.
So, if you're consistent with your bad habits, you can pull it off, or you just get a... No.
Mechanically, you do have to do some correct things in both of those types of swings. You have to be consistent with what the correct downswing motion is for a flat swing. Flat swingers don't need to make a lateral bump to their left side. All they have to do is turn their body. If an upright swing just turned their body, they'd be over the top. You kind of follow that?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a different set of, it's like a different system for those two types of swings. And it's, you know, that's just trying to make it clear for you that there's an upright swing and a flat swing. And there's just different principles coming down. I explain some of that stuff in my book, The Seven Myths of Golf, and why casting isn't bad for an upright swing. But to get to those points, and once you have a clearer vision of what you need to do in your golf swing, and this is where what I think you want to talk about is the mental side. If you have a clearer vision of what you need to do, it becomes more of something that you should just be focusing on, mental stuff, staying in the here and now. To make these changes occur in your golf swing, you have to be present for every shot you hit up in the practice tee. It's interesting. I heard this story about Jack Nicklaus once. I think you'll get a kick out of this.
Go for it.
He was playing in a U.S. Open, and in the third round, I think he lost his four-shot lead by a couple of shots, and he said to his caddy, Angelo, immediately following this round, I'm going to sign my scorecard, and I want to see you over the practice tee. I want to work on my driver. So he got over there, and Angelo had a ball teed up and the driver ready, and Jack made some practice swings, and he started to walk in to hit the ball, and he stopped. And he started to walk in again, and he stopped again, and he just leaned on his driver, and he looked at the ball for maybe 4 or 5 minutes. And then he turned, and he looked at Angelo, and he gave him back the driver, and he says, I got it. I'll see you tomorrow morning. Now, there was a news interviewer there, or a sportscaster or something, and Jack went out the next day and shot maybe like a 66. Anyway, he won the U.S. Open. And the same guy that saw that whole scenario brought it up to him. He said, what was that all about? And Jack said, you know, I couldn't make a clear decision to save my life all day on Saturday. And it was very evident to me when I tried to walk in to hit that practice tee, I couldn't come up with a decision. Now, as I thought about it, that's the way I played golf all day long. No clear decision in my mind on what I wanted to do. Why should I stay up there and beat myself up about my golf swing when there's really nothing wrong with my golf swing? I just had to make up my mind. And that's the interesting thing about getting clear on what you want to do and staying present for the moment of hitting a golf ball. Now, so many times, and you can probably relate to this, you go out to play and you look down the target and you go, there's my target. You know, you look back at the ball, your mind is still in the future. It's at the target.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to stay completely in the moment, which is the only thing you really have, that one moment, and it's the only thing that you can control. The one thing that you can control is perhaps a body motion that you're trying to make. So if you're clear on what that body motion is supposed to be, and you stay in the moment, I'd have to say you have a much better chance at getting your body to make the motion instead of being stuck on what the ball's about to do. Or is this the correct decision? Should I hit a fade here instead of a draw? Should I go back and get that 7-wood instead of my 4-iron? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the place you need to get is a real peaceful mind. And this, you know, this is stuff that's pretty metaphysical. It's stuff that you really have to kind of just do breathing exercises, you know. Staying in the present is just paying attention to what your body feels. And, you know, we go out, we all have goals to play golf. But if your insides don't match your outside goals, then it's highly unlikely that they'll come about. Hitting a golf ball, it really demands your attention in the moment.
Yeah, and it always seems to be easier to be in the moment in the first couple holes than it does later in the round if the ball's not going where you want it that day.
Yeah, yeah, so true. You know, again, forming a good golf swing is important, but staying there for the shot is more important. It's kind of like that quote I heard Woody Allen say once or read about, 90% of life is just showing up. And if you take it, you know, to heart, well, if you can stay at least 90% present for hitting a golf ball, the shot might show up. There's a bit of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It was kind of interesting. I had a recent conversation or through emails with Scott McCarron. I'm working a little bit with him on the mental side of the game, and he kind of touched upon that is so true. Just staying present. And, you know, the best players in the world, and you'll see it on TV, especially like Tiger Woods, you know. I often get the feeling that he was going to stop his swing halfway down before he actually did it. If you ever seen him do that?
Oh, yeah, when somebody takes a picture.
I don't know if it's, maybe that has happened where it's a picture, but there's sometimes a Tiger walks in, and you can almost see that he's indecisive, but he gets all the way up to the golf ball, and he pulls the club back and then makes that stop. And he's so good at catching himself from not being in the moment. He catches himself halfway down his swing. Other guys, and this goes for tour professionals, they might play 2 or 3 shots. High handicappers might play 6 or 7 holes. And then they'll finally say, I've had enough. I'm just going to get up and hit it.
Right.
Well, just saying those words, you just made a verbal commitment to just getting up and hitting it.
And it's amazing. You walk away going, I did it.
Yeah. And, you know, in a lot of ways, your body doesn't remember what you did.
Of course.
Because your mind wasn't there.
Right.
And that's often a comment I hear when somebody hits a good shot out in the course. They'll say, I have no idea what I did right. It's because your mind wasn't there. Your body just showed up.
Are you familiar with Kerry Mumford?
I'm not.
Okay. The clear key system that he's developed?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sounds interesting.
Yeah. Well, I worked a bit with him when I went to the golf academy, the Bird Golf Academy, a couple of weeks back. And he has you repeat a phrase, you address, you're not addressing the ball, you're standing behind the ball looking down, and once you commit to what you're going to do, take your practice swing, commit what you're going to do, he gives you a phrase, and you just repeat this phrase, and it really is nonsensical. It could be anything from Mary had a little lamb, I wish I had one too, to what was the other one he was telling me? It was something about, I've already forgotten it. You know, it was interesting. I forgot it the day he told it, and then when I walked onto the golf course the next day, it just popped into my head. I wish I was Dutch, or if I had a Dutch, I wouldn't be much. Something like that. But you just repeat that a couple times as you walk up, address, and swing. And when he had me do that, I was nailing it each time.
Really?
Because I wasn't stepping up to the ball, addressing it, thinking about it, checking my stance, checking my wrist, checking my posture, checking, thinking about what I have to do on my backswing, bringing the club down, make sure that my hips were not in front, you know, doing all these things. I just cleared my mind all of that stuff.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting because I'm going to relate it to this thing I heard on TV back at the LA Open. Gary McCord was talking about Robert Allenby. And he said, you know, Robert Allenby is interesting right now. He's working on something that's very strange. You know how funny Gary McCord is, he said.
Yeah.
He said to me, he's just trying to be more himself. And then Gary, in his whimsical way, he said, now what's that all about? You know, kind of funny. And I started thinking about that. And, you know, it has a lot to do with the ego. And you know, when you can get your ego out of it, you're just there with your true self, you know. You know, the ego in golf is a killer.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And I would think with
thinking
guys at that level especially.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and those guys, you know, I mean, they're the ones that should have an ego, but they're trying to lose it for 18 holes anyway. But it can, you know, it's just, it can get your attention into different places. You know, if you think about what the ego's all about, it's the one that anticipates. It's nothing more than a self-image maker, you know? And it's just trying to create new images for you. So you're out in the golf course trying to hit a golf ball with your ego, and it's just trying to create new self-images. Can I be good on this one? Will my foursome think I'm a good player after I hit this shot? But if you're just your true self, you're just free. And it's like, you know, when you go play golf by yourself, you're unbounded by everything. You know, it's just such a different feeling.
Well, and that right now, as most of the Northern Hemisphere is starting to thaw out, we come out to the golf course after being in hibernation for a number of months. There's a level of expectation that we have as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's probably not very productive.
Expectations?
Yeah, after, you know, not hitting a ball for a number of months.
Right. Well, I think we mix up expectations and goals, and trying to create goals are actually good. The one thing that, you know, I'd have to tell somebody when they go out and try to hit golf balls and play, there's a certain exercise you should try to do, and it's just, it gets you committed to the shot. It's verbalize your shot. Before you hit it, you'll be up there on the practice tee perhaps by yourself, and people around you might think you're, you know, a nut job or something. But literally just verbalize it, maybe under your breath or to yourself. Out loud is really helpful. I'm going to try to hit a draw off that bunker 10 yards to the left. I want it to draw 10 yards. And then what that verbalization does is it commits you to at least that one shot. So many of us, you know, when we take time off from golf, we're not in touch with that stuff. And we stand up on the tee and we're hitting it with a hope. We're looking down the fairway and going, well, you know, I hope it gets in the green grass. And where does that leave your body? Your body isn't really committed to anything. It's just like, you know, it's probably going to move as fast as it can to get the shot over with.
Well, the antithesis of that is, I hope I don't hit it in the water here.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, a lot of us know by this time that the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, doesn't hear the words like don't. So it just hears, hit it in the water.
Right. Oh, there's that bunker again. I reach it every time.
Yeah. And all that stuff is, you know, it's so far out in the future. If you're hitting it into the here and now, or I'm sorry, if you're swinging in the here and now, all you're really doing is hitting the ball into the unknown, which in so many ways can be kind of exciting. You can certainly see how you're not in control over the ball after it leaves your club face. The only thing you're really in control with is really maybe how relaxed you can stay, keep your body, and make a swing motion.
I'm just absorbing that. That was awesome. It really is all not about hitting the ball. It's about the consistent swing, right?
Yeah. The consistent swing, getting your mind at peace, and staying in the here and now. To get your mind at that peaceful stage, and, you know, we've all experienced this, including me, you go up on the practice tee and you hit balls mindlessly for, you know, even a half an hour and you're getting frustrated. It's kind of like, you know, going through life without any aim, you know. I think most people anyway try to set goals. Goals are good. You get to detach from the goal and make it known, and that's the verbalization on each golf shot you hit up in the practice tee, to put your body and mind together in peace. You know, have a goal, but that's an outside goal. On the inside, you have to get yourself real quiet and understand, and, you know, this is where, you know, some of my stuff that I've learned is just, it's really, some of it's from Jesus and Buddha and the Maharishi. The stuff that they talk about is so good for us when we're walking around a golf course. So much fun to enjoy around the golf, you know? I got a funny story about this. I was teaching a guy down in the desert once, and he was a pretty good golfer, but real intense. And he finally got it one day about how to breathe and how to enjoy himself and don't worry about these swing thoughts. You've got too many of them. This golf swing is going to come when you start relaxing more. And he had a great shot on this hole that we were playing, and he looked down into this pond. Now, mind you, Fred, this is a golf course that he played probably five times a week for the last 10 years. And he looks and he goes, "Look, egrets." I said, "Yeah, they live here." He said, "Really?" He didn't even notice this stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think you were teaching my brother-in-law.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I'm serious. When I go and play with my brother-in-law, and I like seeing wildlife. I mean, my head and eyes have always been popping all over the place anyway, but the only thing he sees is his ball.
Yeah. He's missing out on a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's an intense character, too.
Well, you know, just trying to be yourself like what Robert Allenby was trying to do or still is trying to do, it's so much more powerful for all of us. There's no struggle for approval by anybody, you know. You're just out playing, mm-hmm. You know. I guess you could say there's thinking and then there's doing, and there's anticipation and there's participation, and you just participate in your own round of golf.
Man, you're just full of great quotes today.
Oh, thanks.
That was your book, The Seven Myths of Golf. Last time we spoke, you covered a couple of them. Myth one, keep your head still.
Uh-huh.
Keep your eye on the ball, too.
Yeah.
All right. And people can go, "Lulu, be quiet." You can get
Lulu
your own
read the book.
Yeah, right. Lulu, you can get your own podcast some other time, okay? You can be on the Good Dog Podcast, but right now, be quiet. We do have a Good Dog Podcast. Anyway, so people can go back and listen to the previous discussion and hear some of that. But I'd like to take another two of those myths, if you don't mind, and go over them.
Okay. Let's see. The myth of casting, that's a really interesting myth. Now, this is something that kind of relates to people who are more of a two-plane upright swing. So many times you'll hear that you have to hold on to your angles on the downswing. I'll never forget this one. I was watching San Diego Open last year, and Tiger Woods stood up on like the 14th hole, and he hit this bombing 350-yard drive. And Peter Costas, not to, you know, put Peter down, and he does a lot of great things, but He says the reason Tiger hit the ball so far on that one is because he held on to his angles on his downswing. And then the camera goes to that cool little bizcast or whatever it's called, and the golf ball squished against the club face like a marshmallow, and it's perfectly square. On Sunday, he steps up to the same tee box, hits another 350 or 60-yard drive to the right, about 50 yards into the trees. And now Peter says, with his swing on slow motion, Tiger's swing, he says, the reason the ball went so far to the right is because his angles are far too acute on his downswing. Now, to me, it sounded like the exact same thing. And he brings up the ball squishing on the club face, and I swear to you, it was open about 1 degree. Now, if you think about if the ball only went 270 in the air, he's in the right side of the fairway. 290, maybe light rough. 310, deeper rough. 350, trees. So this whole thing about holding on to your angles opens up the club face more. A two-plane swing is not somebody that wants to do that. An upright swing needs to cast the club. They need to throw it as far from their body as soon as they can. Now, this is something that I learned from a great old teacher. His name was Mike Austin. He's the guy that hit the longest drive ever, 515 yards in a senior tournament, no doubt, using a steel-shafted persimmon wood. He hit a ball 515 yards.
No ice involved?
No ice, no. It was in Las Vegas, but he said there was no wind. And he used to teach me.
And it wasn't
me.
Downhill?
Nope. Now you can look it up.
What, did he hit it in the fairway of the next hole?
It was a short par five, I believe. And I remember him talking about it, and he said that it landed maybe 480 or 470 or something like that. But anyway, he used to say that, you know, the club head, it goes around your body. If you think about the club head and that big circle arc it makes, from the golf ball all the way to the top of your swing, it probably travels in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 feet. Don't you think so?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you can picture that. Now, if you think about how your body has turned, okay, now your belt buckle, it turns away from the golf ball maybe 6 or 7 inches,
right?
Mm-hmm. All right, well, in the downswing, it's going to turn back to the golf ball and hopefully keep turning maybe 12 inches. It does it pretty quick. The club head still has to move that 15 feet. So it's kind of a rate of rotation thing. If you're holding on to your angles with your wrists and your elbow and turning, you're going to be a slicer. So that's the reason you need to cast with your hands as you're turning. It'll get the club head back to square as you're turning. Rate of rotation.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Kind of the image of if you're ever out in a hockey rink and you had one guy stand in a circle and hold hands with three or four people, if he just turned in a small circle, he's going to turn in a very tight, fast, small circle. The guy on the outside is going to be going in a circle, but very gracefully. That's the club head.
Oh, good image.
Okay. One of the other myths, if we have time for it.
Sure.
Keeping your left arm straight. I see this as just something that, you know, you can look at tour pros who hit thousands of balls every week, and their arm is extended, but it's soft. It's not rigid. For those guys that get out to play once a week and maybe hit balls at the driving range the night before, when they keep their left arm straight, it's so rigid and tight that it doesn't create any speed. And if you really think about it, we create whip by creating angles and letting go of them. Now, you wouldn't throw a ball very far if you didn't let your arm fold. So the right arm folds in the golf swing. If the left arm folds a little bit and it's nice and soft, you can create more whip and more club head speed. Those are just two more myths for you, Fred.
It's awesome, Billy. That's why you were the 2006 Northern California PGA Teacher of the Year.
Well, thank you very much, Fred.
And author of The 7 Myths of Golf. Billy Bondurek, thanks so much for spending time with us again.
I always enjoy it.
Do you have a question about specific golf gear or are baffled about what to look for in a category of golf products? Kenny Nicholson, sales manager at EdwinWattsGolf.com, would like to help. And if we use your question on the show, you'll receive a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. To submit your question, send an email to Fred at GolfSmarterPodcast.com with the subject, Ask Kenny. Ask Kenny is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf and EdwinWattsGolf.com, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Kenny Nicholson, how are you?
I'm good. Fred Green, how are you, sir?
I am doing really well, and I'm so glad that you're back because we got a question today from Regis Groton in Shikshini, Pennsylvania. And I'm only going to repeat it because I like to say Shikshini, Pennsylvania. I've never heard. Have you ever heard of Shikshini, Pennsylvania?
I've heard of a few other Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, some of those others, but they have some different names up there.
Yes, they do.
Hopefully he's getting lucky and the weather's going to start clearing for him for some golf soon.
Right, exactly. What about Punxsutawney?
Yeah, they're obviously.
Yeah, and we have a listener in Punxsutawney. I got so excited. Oh, my God, somebody actually lives there other than a rodent.
Other than Phil.
But now we're going back to Shikshini, Pennsylvania. And Regis says, love the show. On several of the shows, you've talked about the benefits of custom club fitting. Yes, we have. And he's gone to several sites mentioned on the podcast and several others, but has not really found one that fits, you know, with the brand name clubs. Now, his question, with name brand clubs that we get bombarded with and why they're the best, what is the best thing to look for in iron heads?
As far as material, well, there's a couple of things to look for. One is going to be what type of player are you? That's the first thing you need to try to figure out. You know, if you're a medium to high handicap, which we've talked about on the show before, you're looking for something that's going to be perimeter weighted, so it has a cavity in the back of it, something that has a little bit more offset. The majority of the major manufacturers out there offer typically three different lines, or at least two. They'll offer a player that's a higher handicap, they'll offer an iron for him. A player that's a medium handicap, they'll offer an iron for him. And a player that's a low handicap or a very good player, they'll offer an iron for him. And I'll touch on those real quick to try to give him an idea as to what he might be looking for. A very good player typically is going to play a blade-type club where there's no cavity in the back of it, a very traditional-looking iron. You'll see those on tour quite a bit. That's for the very good ball striker. The club doesn't have much offset. So what I mean by that is where the shaft goes into the hosel, the club itself is not offset from the hosel. So it's not very forgiving at all. You have to be a very good ball striker. And then you have a medium-type handicap player, a guy that's a fairly good ball striker but needs a little bit of help on his mid to long irons. What I mean by mid would be 6, 5, 4, and then his long irons being a 3-iron or a 2-iron. Those clubs in that set are going to typically have a little bit more offset. And are going to be typically cavity bags, so they're going to have a camber in the back of the golf club. But on the shorter irons, 7, 8, 9, pitch and sand, he doesn't need as much help, so that iron's going to have less offset and going to be a little bit more of a player's type iron. And then you have a high handicap player, which is going to fill the majority of the players out there. There is going to be an iron that has offset throughout the whole set. It is cavity back on the back. And what the cavity does, they're able to take the weight out of the back of the golf club, and they're able to distribute that weight a little bit lower and then out towards the heel and the toe. So we increase moment of inertia, which is less twisting of the golf club. And also, with the center of gravity being low, it's able to increase ball flight. So having a club that's offset with a low center of gravity is going to help get the ball airborne. Thus, you're going to be able to stop the ball on the green, make a lot more putts, things of that nature. So there's a lot of things to look for. You just need to really analyze what type of player you are first and foremost, and once you get that, you can go in there and have a better frame of mind as to what type of iron you're looking for. And I do want to touch base real quick on manufacturers, just in general, typically, because what we, Edwin Watts, is obviously one of the largest sellers in pro-line golf equipment. What we mean by that is, the majority of the products that we sell, you will see on tour. There's some that we sell that you won't see on tour. But these manufacturers spend tons of money in research and development and marketing, which drives price up some, whereas some of these big box stores that sell low-end products, things of that nature, they don't spend as much money in R&D. And what I mean by R&D is research and development. If you have an iron and you just, if you take a block of steel, when they make a cast club, they melt that metal, they pour it into a mold, and they make a golf club, okay? Then they mass produce that and sell it out at retail. Whereas these major manufacturers, these big companies, they don't just take a block of steel, melt it, pour it into a mold, mass produce, and sell. They try to figure out how to make that metal better after they pour it. One in particular, I know this is going real deep, just listen for a second. But one manufacturer in particular, what they do is they do what's called a double heat treat on that iron. Is so after they pour the mold and the metal metal sets up and cools, these molecules, you know, they settle in a certain place. So you're going to have a hot spot in certain places of the golf club. So if you hit it in one spot, it might go further than if you hit it in another. Through research, they found out that this is a problem. So what they do is they heat that golf club again, not to a liquid form, but heat it enough to where these molecules float around, and then they super cool it. So it automatically cools that iron to where those molecules are, there's no imperfection in that golf club, okay? The whole face is solid metal. There's not a hot spot in it at all. And that's some of the things that these manufacturers do to create better golf clubs. They know where to put weight to make that golf club perform better for you. And I wanted to touch on that because some of the products are more expensive than others, and there's a reason behind that. There's a lot more work that goes into making that golf club than some of these others out there. So, and typically in irons, you're going to find that one that costs a little bit more, you're paying for a much better product. So keep that in mind whenever you go out there shopping for your golf clubs.
That's a phenomenal answer. Proof once again, Kenny Nicholson, that you're not a salesman.
Yeah.
I mean, you're an excellent salesman, but you know what you're talking about.
Well, there's a lot more to it than just, you know, selling products. You know, explaining benefits and features is a thing that, we, you know, one of the things that we excel in here. And we learn from some of the best engineers out there in the golf business. You know, they come in here and do product reviews with us, and it's not just, you know, how's this golf club hit? Well, it hits it great. You know, well, tell us what makes this golf club so much better than your previous golf club or so much better than the other golf clubs out there. And, you know, to try to relay that to a customer that's out there shopping, you want to get the point across that there's a reason why these golf clubs are better. There's a lot more done to these golf clubs than in a typical club that's a lot less expensive.
I know doctors have to go through continuing education. But you never think of sales people in a retail business having to go through continuing education, but clearly you have.
Yeah, there's so much training involved because technology changes. Every year there's something new coming out, you know, whether it has to do with moment of inertia or center of gravity or materials or geometry, whatever it is, the industry changes so much. So you have to, we do, all year we do continuing education on new products, and these manufacturers send their best people in here to train our guys in order to relay that information to the consumer.
Yeah, and how about that McGregor NVG2 fairway wood, huh?
Did you like that?
Oh, isn't that a nice one?
Yeah, I like it a lot. It's a very good product.
And that's why we're giving it away.
Absolutely. Somebody's going to be lucky to get that one.
Yep, and we're going to do that on the next episode. And if you'd like to win the McGregor NVG2 fairway wood, send an email with the subject McGregor to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com. Along with your email address, please include your shipping address so that we know where to send the prize when you win. For more information, check the show notes. Deadline for entries is midnight, April 2nd, and the winner will be announced when we produce the program on April 3rd. Also, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com, click on the Edwin Watts Golf link, and that way you can enter the edwinwattsgolf.com website and get full information how you can receive 10% off all your purchases and free shipping. There's some restrictions that apply on those 10% off, but you mostly everything, you'll get 10% off. Kenny, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Fred.
Once again, I want to ask you to check out our new website, smarterpodcasts.com. Remember, it's plural, podcasts. We've also made sure that when you type in golfsmarterpodcast.com, you'll get to our new page on this website. We've moved it, but you'll get there. It's golfsmarterpodcast.com, as always. And we're experimenting right now with a contest page that will make it much easier for you to enter each drawing and know what the current prize is. So even if you've registered for the McGregor NVG2, go ahead and click on the contest page at golfsmarterpodcast.com so that we can make sure that everyone is entered. And next time when you go there, you just start typing. It'll automatically be there for you. And just make sure you put in the code so we don't get spammed. Ugh. And before we close, I really want to thank Ian McCowd of VelocityMedia.com, who came up with the design of the new Golf Smarter Podcast icon logo. I liked it so much, we've now branded the entire Smarter Podcasts lineup with that icon. So, Ian, thanks so much for your volunteering and for helping and for being a Golf Smarter listener. And I ask everyone to check him out at VelocityMedia.com, V-E-L-O-C-I-T-I, Media, M-E-D-I-A.com. This week's closing quote is provided by Bill Frechette of Hermosa Beach, California. Now, I guess it's kind of obvious that I like the bumper sticker quotes, you know? It's not how far, it's how close. And Bill provides me with what he says is one of his favorite quotes of all time. And I agree with not only the quote, but the sentiment that it brings. And the quote is this: play mad, play bad. Please send your quotes, comments, suggestions, requests, and feedback to Fred at golfsmarterpodcast.com.